Hey, Kristen here. Welcome to Trump's America, or so it will be, on January 20th, 2025. Between then and now, he is president-elect. He cannot perform presidential duties, but don't be fooled. Washington, D.C., and the entire United States will be doing a flip. Some of the voters all across the country anticipated this, welcomed this, and their chosen president is in the White House. Others weren't so lucky. The Democratic Party is facing a reckoning. It's really interesting here in Washington as the entire city turns around when administrations change like this. Certain staffers leave, certain staffers come. It's a great time to put your apartment on the market if you were thinking about it, but it's also a great time to dig in your heels, meet people, learn stories. There will be a lot that happens over the next 4 years in Washington and that's impacting places outside of Washington. As always, sign up for our daily newsletter, International Intrigue. It comes out every weekday morning. We give our managing editor, Jeremy Dicker, a shout out in the podcast today, and with good reason. And you can get all of that plus the brains of Valentina in your inbox every weekday morning. All right, now onto the pod.
Good morning, Kristen. Anything going on this week that you noticed?
Just that I cut my own bangs and I'm bangity now. But otherwise, I think things are just cracking along.
Given this is an audio format, Kristen jumped onto our call this morning with a completely different haircut and then proceeded to tell me half an hour about why she cuts her own hair and why she doesn't trust hairdressers with it. That was a good start to the day.
Don't trust hairdressers with your hair, Trump with your country. No, I'm kidding.
Yes, of course. We're here to talk about the election results on Tuesday. And I have to say right up front that you were absolutely correct. You predicted a Trump victory. I predicted a Kamala Harris victory. I thought she would squeak it, just squeak it. And I think you thought that Trump would just squeak it. I think we're both surprised by the scale of the victory, right? Like the popular vote. The Electoral College kind of is a little bit misleading because he won the swing states by not all that much. But the popular vote, I'm shocked by.
Yeah, I mean, it's the, and I election night, someone was like, even Clinton won the popular vote. And it's true. Hillary Clinton, that was the whole thing, right? And then it got everyone up in arms about the Electoral College for the past 8 years. But yeah.
We talked about it briefly too. It's like, in a way, I don't have a dog in the fight. I don't vote here, all that kind of stuff. But in a way, I'm glad that it was decisive because it was, there is no chance that anyone could, contest it or moan about it. I hope that it will prompt, proper post-election postmortems from both sides, but obviously the losing side. That's what elections are supposed to be about, right? Like one side wins, the other side goes, huh, what did we get wrong? Let's go back to the drawing board. And I think if it was a close election, the Democrats probably would have chosen to be like, oh, he lied to people, and they would have done all that kind of stuff they've been doing for the last 8 years. But this should prompt them to go back and figure out what's going wrong. And then on the Trump side, I'm glad that, he won by a lot. If he was going to win, because there's no chance that he was going to contest the result. If Kamala Harris had just won, I think there would have been, we were worried about months and months of contested election stuff. But I do find, again, as a neutral, I do find it incredibly coincidental that all of a sudden there is no talk about how elections are stolen and how it wasn't free and fair. And the minute his supporters are happy with the result, oh, it was a free and fair election. Isn't democracy wonderful?
Yeah. I mean, I will say there was someone in a group chat who was like, I don't know, I smell cheating. And I have seen some trolls just very minor online, on the platforms, as it were. But here's the difference about these two groups is the Democrats are never going to go. I mean, let's not say never, but I don't think a January 6th is going to happen under a Democrat loss versus it very much.
Well, touch wood.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it was a landslide.
It was, not to turn this into a too much of a mea culpa, but I think I misread two things. One, I honestly thought that abortion would be a much bigger issue in the election, but it turns out I think that most folks are willing to have that dealt with by the states. I think the effect, the Trump line in the debate where, hey, I'm not anti-abortion, I don't have a view on it, I just don't think it should be a federal issue, that obviously resonated with folks. And I think, you know, abortion to many people might be a second order issue. It's below things like, can I put food on the table? Are things more expensive? All those kinds of things. I misread that. And I think that's pretty clear because women didn't vote for Kamala Harris in the proportions that we expected them to.
Yeah. I think we sometimes forget just the tenets that this country was founded on. And because obviously it's changed so much and there's, you know, immigrants and foreigners. That's the whole premise that the country is based on, right? That it can kind of evolve and change and new people are welcome and can make a home here. That was at least the thought. But, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of Americans believe that government should be hyper-local and small, and they want to determine what books are read in their school right down the street. And they can think that the argument that let's just leave it up to the states, because I think California, a North Californian resident and a Southwest Michigan guy are just different people.
Yeah, and I've always said, like, again, as an outsider to this country, it really is like probably 8, 9, maybe 10 different countries all within one. It's a little bit like the EU in the sense that, you know, I think someone from Toronto has more in common with someone from New York than someone from, you know, Arizona has with someone from New York. So I think, yeah, it's a little, obviously international borders are a little artificial. So I think that's a good insight. But honestly, and we'll get to, we're gonna talk about sort of some observations that you and I have had about what the election means for kind of the world. But before we do that, I think one of the reasons I thought Kamala Harris would win was that the mainstream media was so in the tank for her. It was very obvious that most of the cable channels with Fox News accepted and most of the big newspapers, and we talked about the endorsements scandal from the Washington Post, all that kind of stuff, but they were so pro-Harris and anti-Trump. I honestly thought that they would move the needle enough for her to win, and they didn't. And I think that's maybe we'll talk about that a bit later, but I think that was another reason why I got it wrong. But you got it right, so all credit to you. You predicted a Trump victory.
What does that say? I mean, just even the newspaper example, who can afford the Washington Post, the LA Times, these subscriptions? Who are the readers that lean on them, that go to their website every day? You know, that's a certain maybe person or a certain demographic. And there was a rejection of that. What is that? I mean, ideas?
Well, I think that's a great jumping off point. So my first, we're going to go through maybe a couple of observations we each had, but my first observation is it sounds fairly standard, but it's this rejection of elitism. And you know, it's one thing to say, oh, Trump wants to drain the swamp or all those kinds of things he used to say and get rid of Washington, but it's bigger than that. And I think what you're talking about is exactly right. It's this idea that the media ecosystem in America and the world has fractured, and I mean, we exist as part of that. We are a small media startup trying to give people information on geopolitics and international news, but we are one of thousands in various different niches now talking directly to a smaller but probably more passionate audience because we've formed bonds with them than people who read the New York Times or certainly the Washington Post, because I mean, the Washington Post is basically irrelevant for anybody who isn't a super, super political elite. And I think it's, you know, I probably discounted how important Joe Rogan is in this kind of election, but it's not just Joe Rogan, it's podcasts in general. The idea that candidates now don't have to go to the mainstream media and have their policies interpreted or interrogated by journalists. They don't actually have to go on 60 Minutes and go on cable TV. They go to people who are largely sympathetic, who will give them an interview that makes them comfortable and, you know, yeah, it could be interesting, but it's not going to be confrontational. It's not going to be, oh, I represent the voters and I'm going to interrogate your plans for the country. It's more like, hey, come, let's have a chat. And you can borrow my audience directly. Joe Rogan is speaking to, I don't know how many, but I think his interview with Donald Trump is up to like 50 million views. Let's say 20 million different people have seen that interview. Joe Rogan's going to talk like, it's trust. Like, oh, I like Joe Rogan. Therefore he's having a nice interview with Donald Trump. Oh, I don't mind Donald Trump. And I think it's that rejection of, yeah, you don't have to go through New York or DC anymore to get your message. You can go to people anywhere and talk to them. And that's very anti-elite. And I know that's weird to say because Joe Rogan makes $100 million from Spotify, but it is anti-elite, right?
Yeah, I think it's also just speaking in a way that is more commonplace, you know?
Yeah, directly to people.
The problem about journalists is, you know, it's a job and their reputations are on the line and they want to sound smart and interesting. And I think you can just say like, hey, when I talk to my neighbor, like he's pissed about XYZ. Like you don't get that from journalists. You get like some sort of teleprompter that feels like a borrowed term, but
have this mentality, I think. And you were trained as a more sort of like, mainstream journalist at the FT and that kind of stuff. It's this idea that you're the guardians of democracy, the bastions of truth. I mean, Washington Post's tagline, which has always annoyed me, is democracy dies in the darkness. But there's that idea that the fourth estate, like you've got the executive, you've got the courts, you've got the legislature, and you've got the journalists keeping all of them to account. And so I think most journalists who are like of that school think of their job not to get someone elected, but to interrogate. And now we know that there's massive liberal bias in the mainstream media, but Joe Rogan doesn't see his job as that, does it? He's like, oh, I just have an interesting chat for 3 hours because my audience listens to me because they find me interesting or funny or whatever it is. And it's at such a different role than journalism.
Yeah, exactly.
And the other thing too about elitism too, I think I said this to you the other day, is I think regardless of your politics, and we've probably got, I think generally our audience is probably pretty 50-50. I mean, centrist overall, but we probably got 50-50 left-leaning and sort of center-right leaning. I don't think we probably have too many wild MAGA or massive socialists listening to us. But I think it is, particularly for our left-leaning audience, you have to grapple with the idea that the Republican Party is now the party of diversity. And that sounds really weird for people because the mainstream media has been saying, oh, white, old Republicans, men, look at, you know, the two female candidates for president have both been Democrats. But the reality is, and I said this to you, I went to business school in London and it's widely touted as, you know, right around the world, 100 nations represented. My biggest takeaway, and I didn't know it before, and maybe this is an obvious thing for other people, but is that money homogenizes people. Everyone who went to business school was, not everyone, but most people who went to business school were from middle class or upper middle class or even wealthy families. And I had more in common with, the Americans who were more likely to be lower middle class or whatever than I did with the Indian guys who came in because they were really wealthy. And they went on the same holidays, they went to the same places as the Chinese wealthy folks or the African wealthy folks or the Brazilian wealthy folks. Like their experiences were so homogenized because that's what money does. And that's what the Democratic Party does, I think now. You can sit there and they say, hey, look at the skin color of that person or the sexual orientation of that person or whatever it is. But Democratic Party now is the party of educated, urban people. And they've got different labels to them, but their experience in the world is very similar. And you know, you can drill down into that and say, oh, they probably own their houses, so they didn't feel the economy quite as much, or they went to the same educational institution, so they have the same views. But the Republican Party, Latino men on the border with Mexico in Texas voted for Donald Trump. People in Michigan who are farmers voted for Donald Trump. Women voted for Donald Trump. Black men voted for Donald Trump. Poor people voted for Donald Trump. Billionaires voted for Donald Trump. Now, that may offend people's inbuilt sense of what the parties are and what they stand for, but that's the reality right now. And that's wild to me.
That might be honestly one of the best points I've heard this entire election cycle and then post, which is that there was also a whole scale rejection of identity politics in the sense of it was thought you have my identity wrong. Like it's not, I am not just a white man in a, who goes to a university, you know, I have more, you know, this idea of like, there's more to me than just, some race label, right? And you're right. It's the money that homogenizes people.
Well, because it's experiences. And that's what Donald Trump is so good at doing. He is such a brilliant politician in that he, everyone who's worked with him, if they love him or hate him, they say he has incredible political instincts for like holding up a mirror to people's feelings. He tells people what they want to hear. And clearly he understood that people's experiences in America are very different. And the Democrats were saying, well, but look, we're a big tent. We've got black people, we've got Latinos, blah, 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 blah. But it's like, no. You've got educated urban people who look different to each other, but that's not their experiences. And they're not experiencing the vast different things that go on in America. But anyway, that was my first takeaway. What's your first takeaway from what this election means?
Yeah, I looked at it more like, I mean, of course I'm going to bring up Bernie's statement. Bernie said, you can just tell.
You burn that, for Bernie, we know it.
Of course, in 2016, I was the person who was like, and this is how Bernie can still win. Actually, no, I was like definitely deep in German land and was sort of like woke up one day and Trump was elected. But... yeah, he said, you know, the Democratic Party should not be surprised that the working class has left them when they have abandoned the working class. Or maybe it was maybe it was flipped that he said that. But yeah, I mean, you know, it really felt like to me at a wider scale, is there sort of this death of liberalism happening, you know, I don't just mean the Democratic Party. I mean the liberal institution, which is they, you know, there's been essentially like, look, we can fulfill some of what you're seeing on the socialist European angle with our American liberal ways. And we're going to make, you know, we're going to give you Medicare for all, Obamacare. We're going to lower education costs. And that has not worked. And you see this with broken promises. Okay. Abortion wasn't codified. If you're a single issue voter on that and you've been looking for the Democratic Party to do that, they haven't delivered. And then you were persuaded by this state argument. So I wonder if there is, I don't know what strategy the Democratic Party will need to whip up to come back in the race in 4 years, but it feels like it's going to have to be very different. And I think we are closing the chapter and the page on an era of liberalism as we know it.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. We don't know, right? This is all speculation, but I think I agree with you. The first Trump presidency could be written off as, oh, an aberration. And I think that's what Joe Biden did, right? He said, hey, order's restored, back to the old ways, you know, the kind of liberal, neoliberal consensus that free trade is generally good. Yes, we've got to like make some adjustments around the margins, but life goes on. And then in a second and such decisive election of Donald Trump, I think it would be a mistake for anybody who doesn't like Donald Trump or doesn't like what the Republican Party stands for. I think it would be a mistake for them to think that this is an aberration as well. So I agree with you. And you know what? I used to live in Chicago, and Chicago is a Democratic city and has been a Democratic city for God knows how long, you know, 50, 60, 70 years. A Republican can't get elected to dog catcher there. It's really a one party city. And you know what? Like there's lots of stuff that doesn't get fixed. There's lots of corruption. And I'm not saying Chicago is not a great city. I loved it, but like there's lots of problems. And it's kind of wild to me that Chicago residents who have those problems don't go, you know what? You've been in power for this long and you haven't fixed it. What the hell? We're going to vote the other people in. And I think it's just so ingrained in culture there that that won't happen. Same as places like, you know, San Francisco and whatnot. But you look at places like New York, traditionally Democratic, moving right. They still went for Kamala Harris, but by a lot less than it did for Joe Biden and for Barack Obama. So I think you're right. I think I don't know if I'd say it's the death of neoliberalism, but I think it's a I mean, this is why democracy is wonderful. It is this kind of idea. Okay, you made us a bunch of promises after the wall fell. And I don't know, jobs have been shipped overseas, but we haven't gotten richer. So it's time to shake things up. It's time to have a different answer. And that's what I still think is the superpower of democracies and such a vibrant one like America's, is that you get to have those pressure releases. Whereas if this was Soviet Russia, you've been in charge since 1940, whatever, 1920, but you've been in charge since World War II and it's 1985 and things are just the same, if not worse. It's enough already. It's like time for a revolution. Whereas this country goes, oh, well, we don't have to have a revolution to have a mini change of course, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I was seeing all these hilarious memes where people were sharing like, oh my gosh, I like graduated high school and Trump was elected and now I'm like 30 or whatever and he's back. And the memes are like people in Turkey and Russia waking up and being like, yeah, what? That's the norm. They stay that long. Like,
That's how it works.
And you're right. Americans, to many degrees, are lucky. They've gotten to, in a whiplash, try out something. I mean, honestly, it is a little bit Diet Coke Republican platforms that Kamala was running on, to be honest. But, you know, they did get to try out these parties back to back very quick and realize they didn't want the one that was in. They wanted the more extreme version.
Mm, okay. My next observation is Trump's election and, well, even more pertinently, J.D. Vance becoming vice president is a huge win for Silicon Valley. I could talk about this for hours, but I won't bore folks too much. But I don't think it's a win for big tech. I don't think it's a win for the Googles and Microsofts and Apples and these folks. I think they've all been very quick to come out and congratulate Trump. And I think their goal for the next 4 years will just stay out of the crosshairs. I think a lot of people assume that Donald Trump will get rid of Lina Khan, who's the antitrust czar in America, who's been trying to break up Google. I think that Vance is very pro that. I think he's backed by the Peter Thiels and the Mark Andreessens and these kinds of folks in Silicon Valley who want those big companies broken up. They see them as monopolists, rightly so. They are monopolists. So I actually feel like the antitrust agenda will stay under Trump, but things like crypto, things like venture capital, speculative tech, kind of Elon Musk's area of going to Mars or building weird missiles, all that kind of stuff, will have a huge boon under Donald Trump. And I think it's really bad news for Europe and the Europe tech industry. The Biden administration was generally pretty sympathetic to EU regulations on tech and kind of bringing them into the US. That's over. The US will chart its own course on technology and it'll be much more laissez-faire while Europe goes down the route of, you know, forcing companies to do what they want. I think America will go the opposite way. And the last thing to note before you reflect on this is Elon Musk is a singular figure. He's I find him personally very abrasive to think about, but there's no denying he's a remarkable character. He gets things done. And I've read a lot about Elon Musk. And apparently when he sets his goals, he basically goes to the place and just sits there and does it until it's figured out. You know, if it's Starlink not doing something, he goes to the factory floor and yells at everyone until everyone fixes a problem. And he kind of did this in this election. He chose to go all in whenever it was, June, whenever that month was. And he did not focus on anything else for the last 4 months. He went all in and that's how he wins. He makes huge bets. And he won. So I think it's a huge win for them. And I'm a little apprehensive about that because I don't like these. I think there's a real problem in Silicon Valley of them thinking that domain expertise in building amazing products and technologies means they're brilliant on everything. I genuinely think they think they're smarter than everybody in the world. And that worries me a little bit because now they've got the levers of power. But I don't know. What were your thoughts?
Two things. Yeah. Big day for people who think that multitasking is not real. Clearly, Elon Musk has proven that if you just say, no, I'm focusing on one thing, it can yield results.
Particularly if you have hundreds of billions of dollars, but yeah.
Particularly. Exactly. Let's not forget that. It's a shame that Berlin, as their entire government was collapsing, they didn't say, maybe we should just like offer all these companies refuge, these or like startups, like give massive grants out. Let's just try for like the next 24 hours to jumpstart our economy with like some sort of mini tech based out of Europe. But yeah, I do remember Lina Khan, and I was just trying to triple check, but she was on the campaign trail at some point for Harris or with at some event that was with Bernie. I wonder how she deals with the Republicans, who she finds friends there. You know, it's the famous thing about Lina Khan is that both people on sort of the libertarian spectrum and the sort of socialist, if you want to, you know, big tent it, do really like her, but the polls of it. So,
well, I wonder. I mean, J.D. Vance gave a bunch of interviews early on before he was vice presidential nominee about how he thinks she's the only one in the Biden administration who's done a good job. So I think she's somewhat popular in a sort of weird way with those folks, but I think she's too political. I think she's too attached to the Biden administration. I wouldn't be surprised if they replace her, but with someone who does very similar kinds of things. But maybe I doubt she stays. She doesn't have the profile for someone who I think Trump would probably be able to work with. But I honestly do expect them to push forward breaking up big tech, or maybe not breaking them up, but like being fairly hostile to monopolies.
Well, and what is – okay, tell me about what breaking up big tech, what ripple effect does that have on American society, then on the world?
Well, I mean, that's a huge question and I don't know the answer, but there is this idea, I guess, that, I think what the Silicon Valley folks would like, and particularly the venture capitalists, they're not doing this out of the goodness of their heart, right? They're finding it harder to get returns. So they want to be able to have companies that can compete with Google's, to take an example, Google has, you know, however many businesses within Google. Breaking them up into separate companies means that you could potentially fund companies who, challenge individual parts of Google's business. But if you have it all within Google, you can't challenge Google because Google can just take huge losses here, big profits there. And then most pertinently, I think, is AI. You see OpenAI being, you know, ChatGPT running the AI kind of narrative, but they're in bed with Microsoft. Immediately Microsoft gobbled them up. So I think there's this idea that, and the other side of it too is they don't want what Lina Khan, I think, and what the Biden administration has done has blocked a lot of acquisitions as their – so there's this problem in Silicon Valley. I'll be quick because we could talk about it all day. But the idea that there is monopolistic power, which means that you can't have innovation because these companies are so big. And traditionally, they haven't done a good job. Like Google's not done a great job for the last couple of years in product innovation. They're not a great company at product innovation now. They're too old. They're too stale. So how do you tackle that? Well, I think the Biden administration has done this thing where it's like, okay, you can't buy young companies. Famously, Facebook buys Instagram, you know, stifles competition because they all just become one of the big tech companies. Silicon Valley doesn't like that because they invest in small companies that they get their money back when a big company buys that small company. You invest in Instagram for $1 million and Facebook buys it for $1 billion 2 years later. Wow, you've just made a ton of money. So they like the acquisitions, but they don't like the size of these companies if you can't compete at all. So there's this idea of like breaking up the big companies, but allowing acquisitions. And I think that's what you'll see in big tech in Silicon Valley. And then for the world, that will make the US tech industry super competitive with European sort of more closed, regulated tech market.
Watch out, Ireland.
Indeed.
They do have like $1 billion they need to spend. So let's see. Okay.
You wanted to talk about the Senate and House races.
Yeah. So I've said since like September that the Republicans will take the Senate. The Democrats will probably control the House. The Republicans could very well take the House. They have taken the Senate and they have 53 seats. 53 seats. That's a lot of power in the Senate where there's just 100 seats. If anyone hasn't taken Gov 101. So just for context, I mean, it really is like what that tells me is any appointee that Trump puts up, any cabinet member, if they have to go through a congressional hearing, there might be a Democrat heckler who's like, let's really give this person a hard time, but it will go through and likely. And that is really interesting for ambassadors because Trump is very well known to appoint ambassadors, often based on who is loyal to his campaign, et cetera, even though there is a 1980s act that's supposed to sort of balance out career diplomats to appointees. Maybe you know more about this, John. I'm woman-splaining you.
No,
the diplomat world.
No, you're not. I didn't know about that act. I just know that it's unusual how many big donors to campaigns get appointed to ambassadorships. And I expect that to be the case again, right?
Right, exactly. And so if he can, you know, if the concern is, okay, I have sort of a tight Senate, tight House, maybe let me, you know, the person who gave me 100,000, who in that moment I was like, you get the Czech Republic, not a big deal because you're going to have a lot more ability to move and shake and
shift. Get through the Senate.
Exactly. And move the pieces where you need. So it's more that I think it's going to be the House Senate races is Trump really has control of Washington.
Well, I don't think it's clear that he's going to win the House, right? That's not,
yes,
I mean, there's still a chance
clear,
that Democrats could win it.
Yes. To be.
And that could take a couple
correct.
Of weeks.
AP News is has not reported on all. There is 25 seats to be called. 211 for the Republicans, 199 for the Democrats. So, yes.
Yeah. And I believe California is where most of those seats are, and apparently it can take a couple of weeks for them to count. I read somewhere that the theory that Trump will probably be hoping that the Democrats maybe win the House because it'll be very, very difficult for him to blame anybody if he's given truly like, you know, 6 seats on the Supreme Court, House majority, Senate majority that's, you know, pretty easy to wave things through, and the presidency. Like, that is unalloyed power, and if he isn't able to do things, he'll there's no one to blame. I mean, that won't stop him trying, but like it'll be less compelling. And maybe we'll talk about this in a bit, but the reality of a lot of the things that he wants to solve is that they're not easy or quick to solve. The southern border, I think, is going to be really difficult for him to solve because he has to work with Mexico. The economy and tariffs and these kinds of things, like there will be, if he puts on tariffs, there will be an initial spike in inflation. Who's he going to blame for that? And I think there's this idea of, well, if he has a Democratic House, even if it's not true that it's their fault, he can be like, aha, you should have given me the House control because otherwise I would have been able to solve it all, and I still can't solve it. But I don't know. That's interesting.
Yeah, I know. God, now we got to – that's the thing. I wonder what people are looking for results for first. The border, economy, and how do they see that result?
All at once, like, please.
Yeah, exactly.
On day one
in 24 hours.
Exactly.
Please,
well,
thank you so much.
That's what he promised. All right, my final observation, and we're going to talk about what's next for the world, but I want to give a quick plug. Next week, you and I, Kristen, are hosting a virtual live event with some experts where we're going to talk more in depth about what a Trump presidency 2.0 will mean for different parts of the world, you know, Ukraine, China, the Middle East. We're going to drill down to that with people who really know what they're talking about. So we're going to keep it relatively high level here. But before we get to that, I just want to say the last thing I was really interested to see is how 2024, the year of elections, how much this has been the year of anti-incumbency. There is a Financial Times, your alma mater, there is a Financial Times graph that says every governing party facing election in a developed country this year lost vote share, the first time that has ever happened since universal suffrage began in 1894. So across the world, I was asked on a webinar that you and I did earlier this week, oh, is this a rightward lurch for parties around the world. And I kind of pushed back and I said, I don't know that that's the right way to think about it. The real way to think about it is if you're in power, you're in trouble. And that to me means that across the developed world, across democracies, people aren't happy with the way the world is going. And it doesn't really matter if it's left or right or your policies are this or that. It's just get out. You've had time to fix it and I don't think you fixed it. And I have this broad theory, Kristen, that there is this sense that life is chaotic now, that it is disordered. And I'm talking about life, no matter what, again, in the developed democratic world, I'm restricting my comments to that. But this idea that the rules of when you were a child and you went and studied and you know, you work your way up in a job and you're promised down the line the bounty of your work, you invested in your future, you know, you paid into a healthcare system that would take care of you, you paid into an education system that would bring you benefits in your middle age or whatever. I think there's a sense around the world that that's breaking and people, they don't understand what the new rules are. There's a lot of cognitive dissonance. People feel they don't know what the new rules are. AI has just come in. Oh my God, is it going to take my job? Oh, like last week you told me it was crypto. I don't really understand, but I'm doing this because I was told that in the 90s, if I did this, I'd be wealthy or at least wealthier than I was. Oh, it's all too much to me. I just want to have my family and I want my friends and I want a job and I want calmness. I want to wake up with news alerts all the time. And I think the pace of change on technology, social media, and all of these kinds of things, it stresses people out because there's no stability and people are hunting around for someone who just goes, hey, I will fix it. Immigration is too much. Wars overseas are too much. Just you're fine. Relax. I'll take care of it. And that explains not just Donald Trump, which it definitely does, but it explains the UK a little bit. That's a left-wing government now that's come in basically saying to get rid of the old guys because it's chaos and they don't know what they're doing. It explains a bunch of elections around the world. And the only person who really bucked that trend was Emmanuel Macron in Paris. But he didn't really buck it because he won an election. He did sneaky things about cutting deals to keep people out. His was far more like clever Machiavellian politics than it was about winning a popular mandate.
Yes, exactly. And my French friend who I see all the time says that always reminds me of that too. Who actually used to work for the French government. Always says, and has met Macron, was an early organizer for Macron back when he kind of came to the scene almost like an Obama figure, but for France. But yeah, no. And then he, people have cut deals, right, to stay in that are in France.
So I kind of exclude them, but Canada, like Justin Trudeau is in a huge amount of trouble.
Huge.
It's interesting. I don't know if you agree with that or if you disagree with that, but just that idea of like everybody generally feels overwhelmed by the world and they want someone to just tell them it's going to be okay.
Well, there's room for better analysis on this that's like packed with a few days of research, but like, is there a through line between the people who have one that aren't the incumbents? Is there something about their messaging? Is there something about their politics? I would find that really interesting too. I mean, maybe it just is. Maybe they are the sort of voice of calm, or maybe not calm, but voice of like, yeah, it's chaos, but like, here's the one truth or I can convince you that I can solve this issue and I'm pinpointing exactly what the core problem is for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think the through line is populism because the right-left divide doesn't really work anymore. If you think about Donald Trump, you know, he's the most protectionist candidate, certainly in 2016, but now he's the most protectionist candidate. And that's like a traditional like far left kind of idea that, you know, subsidies and protect local industries. That's what China does. But then on immigration, he's pretty right wing. So like there's this old, I think, I mean, you mentioned it before. The neoliberal consensus has broken down. There's left wing doesn't mean what I grew up to think it meant. And right wing doesn't mean that either. It's kind of populism and listening to people's problems and telling them that you can fix it, whether or not you can.
Well, and this is why our managing editor, JD Jeremy, is so genius to me, because every time we say right, left, he's like, what is right? What is left?
Mean?
Like, we need to say something about this party. You know, is it anti-immigration or whatnot? So plug for JD. But I think it's something that he said for
a lot
months ago. Yeah. And it's something that hasn't, at first it was sort of like, can we just, let's just call them left. But he's right. Yeah.
I agree. And it's also interesting because it's also not policies that people are promising to save, say, or to win elections. They're not promising, okay, well, we come from a left-wing or a right-wing perspective, and here is the set of policies that are consistent with our ideology, and you should elect us because we're better on the policies. It's individuals saying, regardless of what kind of ideology you'd put my solutions in, vote for me. Vote for me because I will do it. Donald Trump says, right, left, doesn't matter. I will do this thing to solve that problem. And whether you believe him or not, it's kind of like you're voting for the person, not the philosophy. And I think that's interesting. And that's to me the definition of populism, really.
Yeah. Thanks for giving me the definition. I feel like I needed. People are like throwing out populism a lot. No. I'm serious. I'm not even being facetious. I feel like people are like throwing out terms, and I'm like, we're doing the same thing with like left, right. Like, let's be a little bit clearer.
It's one of those words that can mean whatever the hell you want it to mean. I think it's like when we talked about whether Kamala Harris's closing argument of fascism was a good one or not. And I wasn't right on the election, but I was right on that. I think it was a bad move. But fascist means whatever you want it to mean. It means someone you don't like if they're a bit right wing, if you wanted to, or it can mean Hitler. It can mean everything in between. All right. Before we wrap up, let's talk just very, very high level and quickly about what's next for the world. I think obviously we're a foreign policy podcast. So this idea that Trump coming back is going to have some pretty big implications for the rest of the world. You have many views on this, so why don't you kick it off?
Well, no, I want to do, because we're at like 40 minutes, I want to do the same thing we did right last week, where I name a country and you give me like a sentence, so, or a few words or something. Do you remember that structure we did last week? Would you want to do that? Yeah, well, that's what good former diplomat CEOs are for, right, John?
Okay.
Okay, so, I mean, you can expand a little bit, but okay, let's start with Iran. What do you think is in the future for
US-Iran?
This
is the worst outcome for Iran that could have happened. They famously were trying to assassinate Donald Trump, or at least pretending that they were trying to assassinate Donald Trump. They hate him, largely because he has a vision. Well, maybe I'm being too generous. His approach to the Middle East is just shut up and stop fighting. Like, I don't care. I don't want to be involved in it. I'm pro-Israel because, I'm American. He doesn't have the kind of moral disgust with Saudi Arabia that I think traditional politicians do. So he's got, hey, you guys are the big players in the Middle East. What do you have in common? Oh, we hate Iran. Oh, okay. Well, then let's F over Iran then, shall we? And Saudi Arabia goes, huh, that's interesting. And Israel goes, huh, that's interesting. And I think that you will see Iran has a lot on its plate now. They need to manage this very carefully. And I suspect their approach will be to keep their head down and rebuild a lot of the capacity that they've lost in the last year with Hezbollah and Hamas and even the Houthis being attacked. But then they're in no position to show strength. And if they do make that mistake, my view is that Trump would probably greenlight Israel bombing their oil facilities and that kind of stuff. I think it's very bad news for Iran.
Yeah. So if Iran is hypothetically the last person that Donald Trump would ring up, he wouldn't ring up Tehran. I mean, Pezeshkian's not waiting on a hotline from the Oval Office. Who is the first person you think he would call or invite to the White House or go to their capital?
Well, I think obviously Netanyahu will be pretty thrilled. And I think Orban, but again, Hungary doesn't matter. And I stand by that. And that's the hill I will die on, that Hungary is a country that does not matter. Beautiful country. Love visiting it. Great food. Lovely baths. But it doesn't matter. And Orban gets way too much attention. But I think,
John, that I'm just waiting every single podcast I'm just inching you on until you bash, the amount of attention that Hungary gets.
Good.
We
could just call that the podcast. again, beautiful country though. I loved going there. But
great goulash. Anyway.
I don't think Putin will get an invite to the White House, but I think he's going to be pretty happy that Trump's elected. You know, this is the thing. I believe that most foreign leaders, or at least most foreign kind of elite circles, welcome Donald Trump because they think, I mean, they know, and I'm going to say they know, they can negotiate things with Donald Trump that they couldn't negotiate with anybody else because he doesn't have the moral framework that other American politicians do. And the reality is, and I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, is that Donald Trump does not strike good deals. He gets his lunch eaten by a lot of countries. The deals he struck with China in his first term, China absolutely took him to town. Because he doesn't care about the stuff he gives away. If he doesn't care, the deals he strikes, he's like, that thing isn't important to me. This thing is. And that doesn't necessarily reflect America's best interests. So I think a lot of countries around the world will say, excellent. Now let's draw up a list of what we want. Let's draw up a list of what Donald Trump wants. And let's start trading. And almost always they will, I think, out-negotiate Donald Trump.
Hot take. I like it.
And I think Putin will be very happy because I think he will Donald Trump doesn't care about Ukraine. Putin does. He will give something else to Donald Trump that Donald Trump does care about, and Ukraine will be sort of left in the middle.
So, question. Could, you know, when a big part of the German government collapsing and a big part of Scholz's statements – Baerbock statements was focused on that Lindner was not willing to allow this debt brake to be pulled for Ukraine, which the German, the SPD, that sort of the almost the SPD, the Die Grüne, they think that they can, you know, this is a moral obligation. Could, if Trump says, all right, Putin, let's cut a deal about Ukraine, could you, Kiev, just say, well, we're actually really not that interested in having Washington in this dialogue, and we're just going to lean on European partners if capitals like Berlin are saying we're going to come in and save you?
Yeah, but Germany, I mean, come on, Germany's not going to come
and
save you.
The honest question. Yeah,
Europe could. It's the GDP is what, 10 times Russia or something like that. I mean, it's got the power and the ability to do it. I mean, it's not got an armaments industry that's worth much, but you know, it theoretically could, but it's never going to. Germany is all talk and no action on just about everything it does. Since Merkel left, and even before that, Macron is the interesting one. He has always been very strong on Ukraine, and he genuinely is anti-Russia. And I think he wants to have France really dominate the European table. And I think he's got a unique window right now of America pulling back, Germany not being in any shape to lead Europe. So he may be the one that does it, but they're not going to. The other thing too, that you're going to see the narrative change on Ukraine as well, not just from an external position, but Vladimir Klitschko, who I think is the mayor of Kiev, who former boxing heavyweight champion of the world, he recently, I think I read, he recently called Zelensky a dictator because he hasn't had elections and he's been putting off elections because of the war. I think there's some element of, you'll start to see the narrative that has kept Ukraine together by just being like, no, don't worry about that. The world is focused on letting them beat Russia. You'll start to see the fractures in Ukrainian society come to the fore. And that's understandable. They've been at war for 2.5 years. It's brutal. They've lost. It's destroyed the country. So I expect a deal will get done pretty quickly on that. I don't know what it looks like. I'm not expert enough to understand that, but it'll happen.
Yeah, and I think that's you make a really good point. And I don't think that Zelensky, I do think he's a very talented leader and politician. That's probably why he tried to clean house, right? This sort of palace sweep a few months ago to shuffle around cabinet positions. But too bad everyone's going to start looking at his position be swapped.
Yeah. And I mean, I bet you, I don't know, I'm talking out of my hat here, but I bet a lot of Ukrainians would say, you know what, like, it's time to end this war. We're upset about it because we're going to lose a bunch of the country and it's a disgrace and we hate Russia and this is unfinished business. But like, fighting on there's no real hope of victory. Would we want to have 10 years of war? What do we want here? And they're difficult questions to ask. Under a Harris government, I don't think those questions would have been seriously asked. I don't think there would have been a space to have those questions, but under a Trump administration, I think that's what's going to happen. And again, I think Putin will eat Trump's lunch on that, because Trump doesn't care about Ukraine. He cares about not having to deal with it. So, yeah.
Okay, any other observations for the world before we shush?
We've been talking a long time. We could talk forever about it. I think it's important for folks who are after the truth and reality and good analysis to, you know, that's our audience. I think it's important for them to remember that the narrative that they're going to get fed by Donald Trump over the next 4 years is going to be relentlessly negative, for good reason in many ways, but Trump's foreign policy is not all bad. You're going to hear a lot of bad things, but for example, he is anti-war. He doesn't want Americans fighting overseas. I think that's a good thing. I think that would be an uncontroversial view 10, 15 years ago. I mean, Barack Obama got elected on a similar platform. He just didn't do it because he kept fighting the wars. I think the idea that Trump will allow Silicon Valley a freer hand is interesting. That could unleash a new wave of innovation. And America is the only country on this earth that does that. It is the most pro-business country on this planet. And it is the one that, if we are going to go to Mars, or if we are going to create modular nuclear reactors that solve climate change once and for all, if we are going to solve some of these big global problems, it is going to come from America. Like, I really believe that. Not because they're smarter, but because of the business environment. And Trump will, I think, unleash that. Perhaps unintentionally, but he will. So that's a good thing too. And I think that longer term, if you squint, Europe has been free riding for a long time. Europe needs to grip up and
okay, Eldridge Colby.
It's true though. It's 100% true. Like, Europe needs to be. We're going into a fracturing world. That much is clear. And the world, if you believe in democracy and liberal values, which I do, it is better to have a strong, not dependent Europe that can make its own decisions. And I think Trump ushers that in too. So I think the point here, you're going to read a ton of bad stuff about him. And listen, a lot of that's justified. Trump conducts himself in a way that brings it on himself. But I just think people should be a little open-minded about where the world's going and what he does, and not just assume it's bad because Orange Man bad, Trump bad. Let's be a little bit more critical, because there's some good things that I think can come out of it. But that's probably going to get me in a lot of trouble. But that's my view.
All right, John. Well, you know, because
delightful note.
I know, I was going to say, because the climate change could be sold with it, you might as well take that dog behind you out on a walk and touch some grass while you still can.
I think that's an excellent message for everybody in post-election world. Go touch grass, go sit in the sun and have a coffee or whatever it is. Thanks, Kristen. Great to chat as always.
John.
And for the record, I like the bangs.